Before we start this episode of CFD's Podcast for Good, let's give a little shout out to our presenting sponsor, WSECU. WSECU has been a part of the community since 1957 and has been supporting the CFD in a big way since 2011. Thanks to them, we were able to bring you spectacular events and promotions like the Masquerade Ball, Golf for Veterans Tournament, and our incredible First Week to Give, which has been responsible for raising tens of thousands of dollars in donations to charities throughout our community. For more on how WSECU serves charities throughout our community, visit www.wsecu.org/community. And of course, visit our website to find out more about our incredible partnership with WSECU. And now, here's the show. Are you doing anything for 4th of July?
Yeah.
Do you do fireworks?
No.
No? You don't do fireworks?
It's not my favorite. I think more and more as the older I get, I have a bigger problem than anything with the fact that stuff, trash, essentially goes into the sky, explodes, and then shoots back down, and then I panic. Oh, God, I'm polluting everywhere.
Oh, my gosh. I mean, and you know, it does get pretty crazy out there.
I'm the one who's out there in the dark sweeping.
Yeah. That's terrible.
It is. Yeah. Everyone's having a great time, and I'm
who's
just
that,
like,
who's that loser out there who's sweeping?
Nerd.
Yeah. Nice job, narc.
Yep. Totally me. Narc. Go out there and wear my sunglasses. What?
Awesome. All right, so we're rolling here in season two, episode number three. My name is Philip Kerrigan. I'm the program manager of the Washington State Combined Fund Drive. This is, as always,
Heather Lucas, the fiscal and policy coordinator for the Washington State Combined Fund Drive.
Yes, yes, you are.
Yay.
And we have an episode that's a real daunting task this time.
Yeah.
It's on end-of-life care with a focus, I think, kind of on children.
Yeah, really. Yeah. Yeah. So sudden cardiac arrest and end of life care.
So a real feel good topic.
Yeah. These things happen. We gotta talk about them.
Yep. It's a tough thing to talk about. Mm-hmm. And naturally what I did was leave you alone by yourself.
Well, you know, as I was talking with these two charities, I thought, you know, it's probably a good idea for the guy who has three kids to not be here to talk about this.
That's
probably a good idea.
Yeah. So you'll notice when you listen to the two charities that got interviewed that it's just Heather doing the interviewing.
Yeah.
It was because I had to miss that day for actual like childcare reasons, ironically.
Boom.
After hearing kind of how the interviews went, I think you're right. I think it's a little bit easier for me not to hear those sort of things.
Yeah.
These are two charities that we interviewed that really focus on those sort of things. And the first one is the Nick of Time Foundation and the executive director, Darla Varenti.
Yeah.
And then also talked to an adorably named charity that deals with tough stuff, the Ladybug House.
Yeah.
You talked to Colleen Schaefer and the founder, Suzanne Gwynn.
Yes.
Yeah. So basically, you were the only one who actually sat down and interviewed them.
Yeah.
And, you know, seemed like it was a pretty good discussion.
Yeah. Like, you know, of course, like you said, they are daunting topics. And going into it, you know, I thought, oh, this could be really heartrending. This could be one of those things where, you know, Ironheart over here is going to start to get all like,
that's right. That's right.
And I didn't get all weepy. So
that's good.
I was very pleased with myself.
Yeah. There's nothing tougher than, a kid's life cut short or watching them suffer.
Yeah.
And I think that's partly because, they have done virtually nothing wrong.
Yeah.
Right. There's an innocence there and a potential for just life in general.
Yeah.
That you are very sad about.
Yeah.
It ends up making you very sad for the kid and then also the kid's family who can't watch them, you know, fulfill potential or whatever. So that's sort of tough.
Well, one thing that I picked up with both of these organizations is that, you don't expect this to happen to kids. You don't expect kids to die.
Yeah.
And so for end of life care, there aren't places for kids because mm-hmm. people expect like hospice care to be for adults.
Right.
They don't expect that for kids. So nobody's really out there doing a lot for that.
Yeah.
And then with sudden cardiac arrest, mm-hmm. it's something where when it happens, it happens. And that's kind of the end. Like that.
Yeah. I mean cardiac arrest. Cardiac arrest.
Yeah. It results just cardiac arrest for adults results in 50% of those people dying.
Yeah.
So for it to happen to children,
it's tough.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. There's definitely, you feel for, you know, I think everybody knows somebody who lost a child through a miscarriage mm-hmm. or lost a child through stillbirth or even had the child and then later on the child died.
Yeah.
It definitely leaves a long lasting, lifelong scar on the entire family.
Yeah.
And I think that it's nice to hear from people who are attempting to make people's lives better.
Yeah.
Through those really, really just dark times.
Yeah. And one thing that I did come away with as well was like, I think we should all just go and get ECGs and get our hearts checked.
Yeah. Okay.
To see.
Okay.
If there's anything going on.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah. No, I'm super paranoid. I do it all the time.
I'm really paranoid now. I wasn't as paranoid before. I had a friend who died from sudden cardiac arrest, and he wasn't a child who was doing sports or anything, but it's a concern.
Yeah. it's a level 7 concern.
Yeah. Yeah.
So my doctor tells me like you have only a 3% chance of having a heart attack at this age.
Okay.
And I'm always just like I'm always
3%
just like,
too much.
Yeah, it's 3% too much.
Yeah. That's interesting. Your doctor's like, 3%.
Well, they enter it into a little algorithm thingy
into
their computer. And then the computer, like, they enter in your blood pressure statistics, whether you're taking medication for it. They take your food consumption and your alcohol consumption and your workout routines and all that sort of stuff. Your weight.
Stress levels.
Your stress levels. They throw that all in there together and they say, this is the percentage chance you have at having a stroke or heart attack.
Do you have heart disease in your family?
I do.
So okay.
I do. No, I mean, I think if
my family does too.
I think if I'm a go, it's gonna be probably a heart attack
on the basketball court.
No, it'll be because I didn't get on the basketball court enough. I didn't work out enough. See, I gotta work out more.
Yeah,
that's my whole thing.
Yeah.
So before we get into these two interviews, hit me with the question of the podcast.
So when I was doing research about the charities, Ladybug House struck me as an interesting name. So I kind of looked up, you know, why they call themselves that. And then also what it means when you see ladybugs, right? Mm-hmm, so I think that of all the questions that seemed appropriate for this, if you could be a bug, any kind of bug. Ladybugs, by the way, are beetles.
Oh, okay.
Fun fact.
Okay.
What kind of bug would you like to be?
Well, all right. So I'm going to tell you right off the bat what bugs I'm not going to be.
Okay.
All right.
Yeah.
So definitely not a mosquito. They last like 24 hours.
Sure.
Right? And everybody hates them.
Yeah.
Right?
And like bug and insect, I would say these are interchangeable terms.
Okay. Okay. Definitely not the dung beetle or something like that, right?
Just because of the name?
Just because people will make fun of you. Let's see. I probably, insect-wise, I like a bumblebee.
Oh, yeah.
I like a solid bumblebee. Just kind of like...
Like the fuzzy ones?
Yes, the fuzzy one. Because you're just like... Doo-doo-doo-doo-doo.
Here I am, collecting pollen.
I'm just collecting pollen.
Yeah.
And like kids are not scared of you, so they let you hang out. They don't go after you. People don't want to kill you every single minute. You're just a big, fat, happy bumblebee.
They are pretty happy, right?
I'm just going bumblebee.
Yeah. Okay. Right. That's a good answer.
Okay, you.
So, I mean, bumblebee is solid. I like that.
Right?
Yeah. But
nobody ever wants to kill a harmless bumblebee, right?
No, they're like wasps. Get rid of you.
Yeah. But, yeah.
Bumblebee now.
Right.
So if I would go with something else, I think a praying mantis would be sweet.
So you're just looking to kill things.
Yeah.
Also, do you know that praying mantises, like the females rip the head off their male mates?
Yay.
Your face right there was like, oh, yeah. I want to do some head ripping.
Get into my metal mode.
Excuse me, you want what for me? Approve my leave, Philip. Ah!
Is this more about that PDP thing?
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
I'm going to be scared of evaluations from here on out. The bumblebee evaluating the praying mantis doesn't seem like a fair fight. Oh, that's a good one, though. They look weird to me.
Yeah?
Yeah, no, I mean, are they not the weirdest looking creatures?
They have like a weird head and then kind of...
They look alien.
You ever see Space Ghost, Coast to Coast?
I think so, yeah.
So Space Ghost had, you know, DJ kind of spinning over there. He was a praying mantis.
Yeah. I remember that. Yeah. No, I mean, they definitely look like aliens.
Yeah, they
look,
do.
They're like the weirdest looking, one of the weirdest looking insects.
I dig it.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. That's a good one. Yeah. I like that one.
I like the weirdos, though.
Yeah. You do like the weirdos. I wonder why.
Pot, kettle, yeah, black.
That's right. So there you go. If you want to, if you're listening to this, we're going to start something new. It's not going to work because we only still have 12 listeners. But if you're listening to this and you want to take to Twitter, you can tell us what your favorite bug and what bug you would want to be.
Yeah.
That's what we're going to start doing here. We're going to test out people to see if they actually listen at all to anything we're saying. If we're just saying it out loud, nobody's listening.
Well, if we're having fun for ourselves.
Yes, that is true.
That should matter.
That's all that I really actually do this
care
for.
About. Yeah.
So, but if you are listening and you could be a bug, you should let us know what bug you would be.
Yeah.
Say it on Twitter.
Hey.
Yeah. And we'll say, hey, that's a great bug. Or we won't. Because it's a dumb bug. Whatever you pick.
Oh, don't do the dumb bug thing, man.
Don't do dumb bug things.
There's no stupid answer here.
Yeah, that's right. There's no stupid answer. We just want a answer.
An answer. Yeah. Give it to us. Come on.
So what we'll do now is we're going to toss it to the very first charity. That is the Nick of Time Foundation. Executive Director Darla Varenti. Here she is talking about Nick of Time.
So I'm here with Executive Director Darla Varenti for the Nick of Time Foundation. Darla, thanks for joining us.
Good morning.
Good morning, indeed. So can you give us a little history about Nick of Time Foundation and what your organization does for the community?
Well, Nick of Time was started in 2006 in memory of my 16-year-old son, Nicholas, who died from a sudden cardiac arrest. He was this multi-sport athlete, and we had no idea that he had something the matter with his heart that could cause a sudden cardiac arrest. So we decided that, my family decided that it's something that probably other families and parents didn't know about because it's the leading cause of death in exercising young people and on school campuses.
Wow.
So we wanted to make sure that other people knew that this was something that we weren't doing to protect our kids.
Sure.
So we take our kids for well child checks, and then we wear seat belts. You know, we have them wear helmets, we give vaccinations, things, but we're not doing enough to check their hearts to make sure that they're safe to do the things they love. So one of the things, we have three programs. We call them our three life-saving arms. So one is sudden cardiac arrest awareness about why this is important and what you need to do, because there's a difference between a heart attack and a sudden cardiac arrest. A heart attack is what older people get and has to do with arteries and lifestyle and things. But sudden cardiac arrest can happen to anyone at any time, anywhere.
Okay.
And young people are susceptible to it. So it's an electrical problem with the heart, electrical or structural. So when we take our kids for well child checks, we don't check their hearts. The doctors just listen to them.
Okay.
And the only way that you can find the things that are structural or electrical in nature is to take a picture. So we do a lot of awareness to let people know that this is something they need to be aware of. Then we have our ECG Youth Heart Screening Program, which where we go into schools around the Puget Sound area and check the kids' hearts. We actually set up the gym in a big all-day event, and we have doctors and nurses and medical people from all the different hospitals. We have fire department people there helping us. We teach the kids CPR and we check their hearts with a 12-lead EKG and, if needed, an echocardiogram.
Yeah.
And then our third arm is emergency action planning, which we want to make sure that all schools and organizations and communities have an emergency action plan for things that can happen, not only cardiac-wise, but also just for emergencies. And part of that emergency action plan is also making sure that the kids are trained in CPR and how to use an AED. So part of our screening program also is one station, is we teach every kid that comes through it hands-only CPR and how to use an AED.
Nice.
So we figure with those three pieces, we can't screen every kid's heart, because when we go into the gym to do that for a day, we can only screen up to 500 kids just because of time limits. So we know, though, that if we teach every kid hands-only CPR and we make sure that there's AEDs in schools and out in the community and with youth leagues and different places the kids play, those are going to save a kid's life.
Yeah.
So we feel like we've kind of covered the scope of what we need to do to make sure kids are safe. But a lot of it is education, and that's why doing podcasts like this are nice, because people just don't realize that this is something that happens to kids.
Yeah.
And it happens every day in the United States.
Yeah. I had a friend who was maybe 28 and he had that happen.
Yeah. So
and
that's,
it was unbelievable.
Yeah. It happens all the time. Yeah. And when we screen kids, we screen between the ages of 14 and 24. One, because all of our data goes into a research project at the University of Washington, so we had to pick an age range. But it seems like between 14 and 24 is the highest statistic average of kids that have sudden cardiac arrest.
Interesting.
Well, because their bodies change so much during that time, if you think about it. Because I know for my son, what he looked like at 14 and what he looked like at 16.
Oh, yeah, big difference.
He's a completely different kid. So it's something, their heart's a muscle just like the rest of their body, and it grows. But just taking your kid in for a well-child check or sports physical where they listen to the heart isn't enough.
Yeah.
You need to have a picture taken. And that's why this is so important, that we get the word out that this is something that parents need to be aware of.
Yeah.
Because my sister and brother-in-law started the foundation with me, and between our two families, we have seven kids. Nikki was the youngest.
Yeah.
All of them were active. All of them were in school. We were those soccer moms.
Yeah.
We would go in and do things, PTA moms. We were in the schools all the time.
Sure.
And never had any idea that this happened until it happened to Nikki.
Yeah.
So we want to make sure that other families and other communities don't go through what we did, because it's devastating.
Absolutely.
To a community also, not just to a school or to a family. So the awareness piece is huge. We've screened over almost 22,000 kids since we've been doing this program since 2010. And we found a little over 500 that have needed some follow-up. And some of the kids, about 150 of those kids have had procedures done and open heart surgery and different things to be able to correct what we found.
Wow.
Because the thing is if you find it, it can be corrected.
Sure,
and all the kids are back out doing what they love to do. We're being proactive instead of reactive. It doesn't have to end up like what happened to us, where my son actually died. If you can find it ahead of time, then you can get it fixed.
Absolutely.
Or manage it and move forward.
Yeah, and I gotta imagine that day when you come into the schools and the gyms for the kids, that's probably like really fun for them.
It is. Well, we keep it very light and very, my sister actually is the director of operations, and the screening program is her kind of project.
Yeah.
And she does a really good job with it. But we have over 1,000 people that volunteer for us that help us put these on. We use about 125 volunteers at each screening. We've got on our website right now, we have already the schedule for next year put together, so that we, on August 15th, we're going to be at King's School in Shoreline, but we're going to be partnering with the Seattle United Soccer Club and screening all their athletes.
Right on.
So that's a new program that we're starting. We're also just introducing another program this fall that is called our Nick of Time Express. We've had a lot of call for around the state, and we're a small nonprofit, but we try to get to as many places as we can.
Sure,
but for the screening program, it's usually kind of within an hour and a half of Seattle, because that's how we can pull our medical people. But we've had, of course, other places in the state that want us to come do this.
Yeah.
And it's always a little bit harder to kind of, I call it taking our circus on the road, because it's a huge production.
Sure, yeah.
And a lot of times we ask the communities that we go to that are away from where we would normally screen to help us with medical people, because we do have a large group of doctors that help us in the Puget Sound. But because rural areas don't have the same kind of medical facilities that we do, it's not always easy to do that, and it kind of limits our ability to be able to go to some of these outlying areas, because they don't have the doctors. At any given time at one of the Puget Sound screenings that we do, we'll have 17 to 24 doctors there from all different hospital and medical facilities all across the area. Where when we go into a rural community, they might only have one cardiologist. They might only have a couple family practitioners. A lot of times, because we use sonographers too in our program, that they have one sonographer for the whole community. So it's not always easy to be able to pull from their resources to be able to help us put this on. And this is a teaching opportunity for us. We want to go in and teach them how to read an ECG correctly, because you can't read a kid's ECG the same way you'd read a 50-year-old man's ECG.
Especially if they're going through all those changes and their body's
still
growing.
Their hearts are just different. And there's things that on the, like, especially if the kid's an athlete, their heart's going to look completely different, and there may be some things that you think might be a red flag, but aren't really. So our team has developed this. It's called the International Criteria that they use now all across the world. FIFA's using it. The Olympic Committee's using it. All the NCAA schools that are doing screening are using it. So this criteria that they use to read the ECGs is super important. So when we go into these rural communities, we hope to teach them there how to do this with the help of our medical team. and then they can carry it on. And we know it's been successful because there's a group up in Skagit that have been, that we did it with screening for them, and now once a year or twice a year they hold a screening on their own because nice. They've been able to learn how to do it. So the new program we're introducing is called the Nick of Time Express. It allows us to take 6 to 8 volunteers instead of the 125 that we usually do. Allows us to go with one doctor, and we can screen 100 kids and be able to be a lot more portable and be able to not have to rely on the local community as much, sure. but yet invite them to come and sit with our doctors so that they can learn how to do it and hopefully then continue it on in their community. So we're very excited about introducing this new program. It's taken us 2 years to kind of get it developed, and it's patterned after a program that they use in the UK.
Okay.
That my sister and I traveled there 2 years ago to kind of learn about it.
Yeah.
So we brought it back, and we, with the help of our medical director, Dr. Jonathan Dresner at the University of Washington, we've been able to develop this program. So we're really excited about introducing that this fall.
Nice.
Because it's going to allow us to be portable and be able to get everywhere in the state.
Yeah, that would be really great.
That asks us, yeah, and be able to pick up and go and be able to do 100 kids, where we do over 500 kids at a normal screening.
Sure. Right on. So can you talk about any kind of symptoms that a child could experience with sudden cardiac arrest, or like the survivor's report having experienced?
Well, one of the biggest things is especially with young people, the mm-hmm. first sign of a sudden cardiac arrest or there's something the matter is the sudden cardiac arrest.
Oh, that's it? Just yeah, flat out?
Flat out, they have the sudden cardiac arrest. That's what happened with my son. So, and that's a lot of the reports. That's what, there was no indication ahead of time. If you look at the picture of that we have on our website of Nick, that was taken a week before he died, you never know by looking at him
sure.
that there's something the matter with his heart. So that's the first thing the parents have to realize, is that you can't tell by looking at your child that there's something the matter with their heart. But there can be some indications if they faint.
Uh-huh.
A child fainting is not normal.
Not normal, yeah.
So that's something that's a red yeah. flag right there. They can't blame it on not eating or mm-hmm. not getting enough water, or sometimes
like
with a young woman, a period or something. You mm-hmm. can't, that's not, it's not normal.
Yeah.
So those are things you have to watch out for. You also, if there's excessive tired, there's kids going to be tired after they work out or they've mm-hmm. done sports practice, but if it's an excessive amount of being tired. So those are kind of things. If there's any kind of chest pain that doesn't seem normal. The problem is with a lot of these kids who have had problems, we know that it probably feels normal for them.
Yeah.
And that we've had reports from the kids who we found and who've been able to correct the problem that they found, that they had no idea that their heart felt differently.
They just thought it was something
because
else.
Because it was normal for them. Yeah. Their heart felt normal. There's a young man that we found a few years ago who actually, our doctors stopped his activity and sent him home from the screening because his heart valves were so bad.
Oh, wow.
And 6 weeks later, he had open heart surgery. But he had ran 5 miles the night before because he was a cross-country runner and didn't have any idea that his heart wasn't feeling like it should, because that was normal for him.
Like he could have chalked it up to maybe just I work out too much,
this is just how my heart feels.
Stressed out, or yeah, like this is every day.
Yeah, so that's not, they don't realize until the problem is fixed that their heart, how they feel now is normal, where what they were feeling before wasn't, but for them it was normal because that's how it had always felt.
They just got used to it.
So those are the kind of things, so you can't really, there's not a lot of symptoms that you can look for, like I said, because a lot of times it happens. So the best way to prevent that is do some proactive things, which is what the ECG testing is. And talking to your kid about family history. Because
mm-hmm.
a lot of times kids don't talk to their parents, and the parents don't think about that they had a cousin that maybe died when they were 15 or 16.
Sure.
So what we're finding now, too, when they go back and look, is a lot of times drownings
mm-hmm.
or single car accidents are not necessarily drownings. The person had a sudden cardiac arrest.
And then
the water.
Drove right. into the water, right.
Right, and then the other is single car accidents. Yeah. They could have a sudden cardiac arrest while driving and then get into an accident. So if there's nothing on the road that could cause them, there's no weather related, they weren't drinking, they wasn't tired, those are kind of things that you have to go back and look at. So being able to get it tested ahead of time, mm-hmm. and being able to talk to your kid about family history, too, because if there's anybody that's died in your family under the age of 40 suddenly, that's a red flag, and that's something you need to talk to your pediatrician about, or family practice doctor.
So as far as ECGs, what kind of age should people and parents start thinking, I need to get this for my child?
Well, like I said, we've picked 14 to 24 because that's kind of the biggest statistic-wise. Mm-hmm. That's the average range. But we have kids who come to the screening, especially siblings and things of older kids mm-hmm. who are down to the age of 12. We do have groups that we've partnered with, or the community groups that we know of that we're friends with across the states that do children that are younger.
Uh-huh.
But we choose to do that age range just because that's when the kids are changing so much. But I would say if there's any, if you feel like your kid's having problems or if...
Like a possibility exists.
Yeah, just go talk to your pediatrician. Some pediatricians have the ability to be able to do an ECG and can talk to you about it. So if there's any kind of family history, if there's any kind of symptom, a lot of times they'll be able to do it. But we've also found that there are some pediatricians' offices that don't even have an ECG machine.
Ah.
So that's also kind of something that you have to talk to your... But opening the dialogue to be able to kind of say, this is something I'm concerned about. This is something that I think that we should explore further.
Uh-huh.
But we also have pediatricians that refer patients to us.
Oh, wow.
To come when we do our screening, so that we have parents call us and say, our pediatrician just told us to come get our kids screened at one of your screenings. Is that possible? And our screenings are open, even though they're hosted at different high schools around the area, they're open to any child between the ages of 14 and 24.
So if a kid lives in Kent and you've got a screening in Shelton, they could go.
Yeah, they could go. It doesn't make any difference where they live. We've had screenings in Seattle where people have come from Olympia.
Yeah.
We've had them come from Bellingham. So they can come from all over to come and have their kids screened. All they have to do is get online and sign up.
Right on. So are sports physicals comprehensive enough? We talked a little bit about that, but they don't really reveal any possibilities for
because a lot of times, too, it's like a cattle call. Like the kids are all lined up and they just go through, you know, before school
starts.
You've
got a certain time of period when you have to get it done, right?
Yeah, you do. The only thing that, I'm a little bit upset about with Washington State is that they've changed the rules, so now kids only have to get them every 2 years. And I think that's a mistake.
You think it should be annually?
The kids should be every year. So we actually tell parents to look for us and that get the kids heart screened every 2 years because that's kind of the way they can follow. If they know if they're taking their kid for a sports physical, then they should look for us to be able to, you know, come and visit one of our screenings. But I think that they're not comprehensive enough. They don't go into detail enough about a lot of times. You can't, we found because of the research that's been published from our data, from our medical team, that they found that a ECG or that a sports physical with just history, family history, and just a physical alone is not enough.
Yeah.
It doesn't pick up the things that you can find with an ECG, because an ECG can pick up probably 90% of the things that are wrong with a heart with a simple 5-minute test.
Wow.
Where by asking questions and just having a regular physical, you can't find those things. So it's really important that they work hand in hand. So a family history and physical is not enough. You need to add the extra piece.
And I'm sure, too, when it comes to a kid responding, like a teenager is going to know a lot more about their own body than, say, an 8-year-old and be able to respond to an adult better. But even then, I mean, a kid could say, you know, I'm just normally worn out.
Oh, I know. I think that if my son would have had, if we would have caught this and they would have said, you have to stop playing for a while, that would have been devastating for him.
Oh, yeah.
Because football was his life. But I think that in the long run, when you find something and you tell a child that they need to stop for a week or two until we can get it looked at.
Yeah.
For me as a mom who's lost a child, that's a no-brainer to me.
Yeah.
The kid needs to sit out for 2 weeks until we figure out what's going on. But when you ask a child that, it's not always, that's not their answer.
Of course. I mean, that's their life, their friends, their social activities. Absolutely.
Yeah. So they don't want to keep playing. And a lot of times if they feel something, I know that they don't want to tell a coach.
Yeah.
Because then they might
get
binged.
They don't want to get
pulled. Yeah. And they won't be able to play. So it's definitely something that you need to, as a parent, to open up the dialogue. And also, I don't think that you should give them the choice of whether they want to get their heart checked or not. That sometimes you have to be the child's advocate. And this is one of those times when you have to say, I understand you don't want to do this, or I understand that you don't think this is necessary, but for my peace of mind, it's something that I think that we need to look
at. Now's the time that we're doing this.
Yeah, and it's so easy. Like I said, it takes 5 minutes to do an ECG. That basically it takes them longer to lay down and attach the stickers than it does the actual test. All they have to do is lay there for a minute quietly for the test to be done.
Just hold still.
So it's just peace of mind. And it's also, but then also parents need to realize just because they have it done once doesn't mean that they shouldn't follow up, because the kids' bodies do change so much. So that's something that we really try to stress too, that this is something, it's not a one and done.
Yeah.
That you need to keep having your child's heart checked and looked at, especially as the kids grow.
And I can imagine after a certain period, like if you have an ECG and everything comes out as your heart is normal and it's functioning properly, a couple years later, if there's another thing where it's like your heart is normal and functioning properly, moving into adulthood, I'd assume at that point everything should be okay.
Well, yeah, and it's still, I think periodically you still need to have it done, but definitely it's more vital while the kids are teenagers to be able to get it checked just to make sure.
Have you had it done?
Yes.
Nice.
Yeah, of course. Right after, well, I shouldn't say of course, but after Nikki died, our whole family was checked because a lot of the things that we find in young people are very hereditary. The young man that I mentioned that was a cross-country runner, the connective tissue disease that basically ended up making his valves bad.
Yeah.
They also, when they tested the rest of the family, they found it in his dad and his aunt.
Oh, wow.
So they, those are a lot of the things that we find are very hereditary.
Okay.
So that we always encourage the family that if we find something, that then they need to get the rest of the family checked. Because we, there's an electrical issue called long QT.
Okay.
And it's hereditary. And we found it in a young woman at one of the screenings that we did. And then a few months later, we got an email from a man from Texas who was this young woman's uncle, who, when they found it in her, the rest of the family got checked, and his two daughters had it also.
Oh, wow.
So that's something that is vitally important, that you make sure that the rest of the family gets checked when something like this happens, because you want to make sure that the rest of the family doesn't have it that you don't know about.
Yeah, and I can imagine, like, doing this work in general, the people that you work with, like your sister's family, like, you would all have done this just because this is what you do.
Yeah, we do. And every once in a while, we periodically, you know, use everybody, the family as test dummies to try different things. But no, I think that it's an awareness piece. Mm-hmm. It makes you really aware of what's going on around you, and that when you hear about young people dying in their sleep or, you know, something happens, my first always thought is that it's the child's heart. I hope that the rest of the family's gotten checked.
Yeah.
So we've worked with local groups too to try to make sure that when there is a death, that the coroner realizes that this is something they need to tell the family, go get checked, make sure that it's not something that, you know, is hereditary. Mm-hmm. Because the biggest issue for me is that when a child dies like this, that they actually have no recourse but to mark it as a natural death. And for me, a 16-year-old boy dying is not natural. No. So there has to be another way, because the biggest thing is that we don't know exactly how many kids this suffer from this every year. The American Heart Association estimates it's like 7,000 to 9,000 kids a year. But there's no way of knowing, because there's not any accurate records being taken.
So if that changed how records are taken about,
that would let us know how many kids actually are dying from sudden cardiac arrest, because that's, it's huge. We know for a fact that it's the leading cause of death on school campuses, because they have kept those records.
Yeah.
But kids who die outside of school campus,
yeah,
you know, technically my son died in his sleep. He had played in two football games and then went to sleep and didn't wake up the next morning. So technically he was at home. He wouldn't have been considered on a school campus, but yet he was an athlete. We know that this was, you know, something that was the matter with his heart. So those are the kind of kids that you want to pick up. And the kids who have sudden cardiac arrest, you hear about reports. There was one period for 2 weeks in May where we had seven kids that had had a sudden cardiac arrest, and we had three right here in the Puget Sound.
Yeah.
One child was at a track meet in Walla Walla, and the athletic trainer had an AED and was able to start CPR, applied the AED, and they were able to save his life. Another boy who was in Federal Way was playing soccer 2 days later, and they didn't have an AED. They didn't actually recognize that it was a sudden cardiac arrest, because he had been seen on the bench and fell over, and there was a metal grate next to the bench, and he hit his head, and his head was bleeding. So they thought it was a head injury when it was actually his heart.
Oh, wow.
So he went 9 minutes without CPR. So that's tragic right there. Yeah. You want to make sure that at least people recognize, that's part of our emergency action planning, is to recognize that if it's a cardiac issue. You don't have to worry about if there's no pulse and they're not responsive, start CPR.
Sure.
The thing is if they don't need the CPR, they're going to look at you and say, cut that out. That hurts.
Yeah.
So it's always, we want people to realize that
CPR is a good thing to start.
Right, that they should start that right away. And then another child we had that had a sudden cardiac arrest and didn't survive. So it happens in our area. It's not something that happens to someone else.
Yeah.
I mean, it happens all the time. So parents need to be aware that this is something, they just get their kids' hearts checked. It's a simple piece that they can add when they go for a physical.
Mm-hmm.
If their doctor's not receptive, then find us. Get on our website and look and see where we're at. Because, like I said, our screenings are open to everyone.
So being based in Washington State, do you think that as a state we do okay, good, bad,
well,
as far as
well,
it goes?
we're not the best.
Okay.
I mean, we score high on the Corey Stringer Institute emergency action planning piece that they've done. I think we were 10th, which was pretty good.
Okay.
But we still have a lot of work to do because the cardiac piece of that we scored high on, but that's because we've been able to help with the help of legislators in Olympia be able to pass a couple laws. One we did in 2013, which was the CPR in schools bill, which passed so that every child had to be taught CPR and how to use an AED before they graduate from high school. Oh, that was a curriculum change we did. That was huge. Then in 2015, we were lucky enough to get the Sudden Cardiac Arrest Awareness Act passed, which is based on what the Lystet law is. So now that any young person who participates in sports at a school or any student that's in a youth organization that uses a school field, public and private, have to read this paperwork about sudden cardiac arrest with their parents, and they have to sign a sheet that said that they've aware of it, just like they do for concussions.
Sure.
And then also a piece of it is that the coaches have to be trained every 3 years in sudden cardiac arrest and about cardiac emergencies. So that was a huge piece for us. Yeah. That's probably one of the most exciting things that we were able to get passed in the state, because we're a small nonprofit. We can't be everywhere.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So this helps us be able to get the word out across the state. We're finding, though, last year I found a couple schools that had no idea about this, even though it was passed in 2015. So our push for this year, a new initiative for us, is to make sure that every high school in the state is aware that this has to be a piece that they have either on their website or access, the parents have access to it so they can get it done. But a lot of the youth leagues have been very proactive. The soccer teams in our areas in Washington State have been amazing about it, been able to pull it together. So it's an awareness piece.
Yeah.
We still have a lot to do. We still have a long ways to go to be able to make sure everybody knows about it.
Yeah. So it's funny you mentioned soccer. When I was doing research for the topic today, I actually saw that a charity we interviewed, Washington Youth Soccer League, they have this whole piece about sudden cardiac arrest on their website. And I thought, oh, look at you guys.
I know. And it's because of this law we got passed. Yeah. When it was, that was amazing for us. It was so exciting. It actually was, it took us forever to get the CPR in schools bill passed. But the legislation, because Rosemary McAuliffe helped us, within 2 months we had that passed. It was like, I still, even watching Governor Inslee sign the bill, I was like, this could be real. Yeah, because it's like, this went through so easy, so fast. People really understood this, and it's going to make such a significant difference. And like I said, the soccer leagues have been amazing. Any of the soccer leagues that you get onto and look at their paperwork, they always have the piece there. And the little collateral piece that they use to do the information is something that we produce. So it's exciting for me, because I know that will affect so many people all over the state. Even though it's geared toward athletes and the youth groups that use the fields and things, it's still, it's a piece, it starts. And then we hope that opens a dialogue so people talk about why this is important and why they need to protect their kids.
Absolutely.
Because we think every child has the right to be able to do things they love without worrying about if their heart's going to, you know, be safe or not to do it.
Yeah, absolutely. So let's say someone listens to the podcast and they decide that they want to start giving to Nick of Time Foundation. Can you talk a little bit about what donations do for you guys?
Well, they help our programs move forward. Mm-hmm. We do ask for a donation when we do the screenings, but essentially we don't mandate that that's something that has to be done before we do a screening.
Sure.
So each family, we ask for a donation for them to be able to help support us, but most of the time that doesn't happen. So any money that gets donated to us helps us provide screenings for kids and helps us cover more kids at every screening. It also helps our CPR programs to be able to be out in the community, especially during the summer, because we run on the school schedule, basically. We run from September until June with our screening program. But during the summer, we do a lot of community events where we go out and go to festivals and go to community picnics and things and teach hands-only CPR to everybody. So that allows us to be able to do that to reach more people, because CPR, everybody needs to know CPR.
Yeah.
And you can learn it in 5 minutes.
Yeah, you can.
So it's real, and it sticks with you. And that's why we love teaching kids, because they don't have a fear. They don't worry about if somebody's down on the ground, if they're going to catch something or why they're there or something. The kids jump into action.
Somebody needs help.
Yeah, we know it works, because one of the schools that we screened at, the wrestling coach made all his kids come through because he had had somebody when he was in college, a roommate or a friend, die from sudden cardiac arrest. So the wrestling team came through, got all their hearts screened, and learned, as I said, when we do the screening program, every kid has to go through the CPR station. And 2 weeks later, after the screening, mm-hmm. he had a sudden cardiac arrest during one of the practices, and the kid started CPR and saved his life.
Wow.
So we know the kid, it works. Nice. We know that the kids are learning it. They learn it through lifeguarding or babysitting or one of our events, that CPR really does work.
Yeah.
We're fortunate in the Seattle area, because of King County Medic One and the Medic One Foundation, mm-hmm. if you're in Seattle, we have the highest incident of saves from CPR or from sudden cardiac arrest anywhere in the world.
Really?
But if you get outside that King County area and the Seattle area, it starts to get less and less. So the more people that know CPR, the better off we are. Plus, we think that the kids are the next generation of first responders. They're going to save our life.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
And we try to tell the kids, too, that when they're learning CPR, that 80% of the time, you're going to end up using it on someone you know or love.
Mm-hmm.
So it might be at home, it might be a grandparent or parent, or, you know, it could be anybody.
Yeah.
So that when you learn it, it's something that usually stays with you.
Yeah.
And especially now that you don't have to do the rescue breathing, that all you have to do is the compressions, it's so much easier to do.
Yeah.
And it's, any kind of CPR is better than no CPR.
Yeah, absolutely.
So even if you think you can't do it, just starting it and making sure that, you know, that you're at least getting the blood circulating helps.
Absolutely.
And like I said, if somebody doesn't need CPR, they'll sit up and tell you they don't need it.
Stop pounding on my chest.
You're hurting me.
So before we go, do you have any upcoming events or any other programs that you wanted to highlight?
Well, we're going to be at a couple different events around the Puget Sound area.
Okay.
We're going to be at the Edmonds, the Taste of Edmonds, which
okay.
we're very excited about, and different those kind of programs. We're going to do the National Night Out. So those are going to be fun. But our first screening for the new year will start on August 15th. That's going to be at King's School, like I said, in partnership with the Seattle United Soccer Club. We're actually doing it in memory of a soccer player who was at the University of Washington who died young, and his name was Daniel Phelps, and we're actually doing it in conjunction with his family and also the Seattle United and UW Soccer. So that's going to be a special event. Then in October, we're kicking off our Nick of Time Express. We're going to do 2 Nick of Time Express that month, and then in November, we're going to be in Arlington High School up north. So if they get on our website, they can see our whole schedule
nice.
For the whole year and be able to come and find us.
Right on. Well, I'm sure that your son would be extraordinarily proud of everything that you're doing.
I don't know. He was pretty shy kid. He'd probably be upset that his mom was talking about him.
Mom!
But, I know. But for us, every day somebody says Nikki's name, so it helps keep his memory alive
yeah.
for us. And really, I feel like we couldn't do anything for him. We couldn't be proactive for him, but I can be proactive for other families.
Absolutely. Well, thank you for coming onto the podcast,
Thank you
Darla.
For asking us.
Okay, so that was Darla Varenti, the executive director of the Nick of Time Foundation. We're going to toss you right into the next interview. Colleen Schaefer and the founder and CEO of Ladybug House, Suzanne Gwen. Here they are.
So I'm here with founder and CEO Suzanne Gwen of Ladybug House. Suzanne, thanks for joining us.
Oh, thank you for having us.
So can you give a little history about Ladybug House and what you do for the community?
Well, Ladybug House is a grassroots nonprofit,
mm-hmm.
and our goal is to build a freestanding home in the community that will support families who are supporting their children with life-limiting illnesses. We'll also be that shelter and refuge for families
okay.
at end of life. So when medicine can no longer add days to the life of their child,
mm-hmm.
Ladybug House will add life to their days.
Nice. And when were you founded?
We were founded in, well, I was a nurse at Seattle Children's until 2013,
okay.
and after 18 years of saying somebody should do something, I realized that I was somebody, and
yeah.
so I jumped on. And in 2013, I spent the year doing a feasibility study, which I didn't know I was doing, just asking everybody, do we need this? And
uh-huh.
we did. So 2014, we became a 501c3.
Okay, right on. So I read that hospice care treats a person and not a disease.
Mm-hmm.
So how does Ladybug House treat a person when they come to to your organization?
Well, for one thing, you know, hospice is a philosophy of care, you know, so it's not a place. And so there's really, it starts even, you know, we have this new big word, palliative care.
Yeah.
Palliative care, which means to cloak or to comfort, an extra layer of support.
Okay.
So really, palliative care can start with anybody at the beginning of any diagnosis and carries on through the trajectory. It's a supportive, multidisciplinary team that supports not only the patient, mm-hmm. but their caregivers,
okay.
their whole support team. And then it goes on to either cure or end-of-life support. End-of-life support is hospice support.
Okay.
So really, Ladybug House will be more about, you know, our mission is to, like I said, if we cannot add days to the life of a child, we'll add life to their days.
Mm-hmm.
And so our goal really is to support the family during their whole journey, from time of diagnosis, be a place for rest and support, and then end-of-life support in the community if and when they need it.
Okay. And then as far as where you'd be located, what's the ultimate goal for Ladybug House?
Well, you know, pediatric palliative care started over 35 years ago in the UK,
okay.
and now they have 55. When I started this 4 years ago, they have 47.
In the United States?
In the UK.
Oh, in the UK.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
They now have 55. They're supported, most of them are 100% supported by their community.
Okay.
In North America, the very first pediatric palliative care home was built in British Columbia, and that was about 27 years ago.
Okay.
Canada has 8, with 2 now in British Columbia. They built a second one in Abbotsford 3 years ago.
Okay.
And they're supported about 87%, I think, by the community, and the rest of it, you know, the small portion by the government. Yet here in the United States, we currently have 2 pediatric palliative care homes.
2?
Mm-hmm.
For the entire country?
For the entire country.
That's
one in San Leandro, California, the George Mark House, was built 12 years ago.
Okay.
And then Ryan House was built 7 years ago.
Okay.
Ryan is actually a survivor. He has spinal muscular atrophy.
Okay.
And he was born in the UK. So his parents would take Ryan to the house. The first house was called Helen House. And they would take Ryan to Helen House. They'd leave him for the weekend. They would go home, sleep, rest. Ryan would get to hang out with other kids and not be a sick kid, but just be a kid.
Yeah.
And so they would pick him up. So when they were transferred back to the United States, to Arizona, they're like, where is our Helen House? Where do we take Ryan? And they found it at the time there was only one place in the entire country. So Ladybug House hopefully will be the same thing for the families of our community.
Okay. So you say that that's not something that's supported, like insurance doesn't cover
mm-hmm.
anything
mm-hmm.
when it comes to a child who's at an end-of-life stage.
What happens is there is insurance benefits for adults for mm-hmm. hospice support, but remember again, parents are not putting their children into hospice. To go into hospice, you have to have a prognosis of 6 months or less
mm-hmm.
to live. And even though there's concurrent care, which says kids can get curative and hospice support benefits at the same time, they still have to jump over that broom and accept that their children is, quote, their child's going into hospice. Then they can get the other benefit. And parents will do absolutely anything to fight for their child. I mean, to the very last day.
Mm-hmm.
Palliative care is a multidisciplinary team of supports. And the thing that's different with Ladybug House is that it will be a home in the community. We hope to have a home in the community. They would have 12 family suites.
Okay.
Each suite would support up to 6 family members.
Okay.
And we hope to have a kennel in the back for them to bring their pets. We hope to have a place where kids can come solo, like Ryan would go for the weekend.
Sure.
Or those families that come from far away, even Bellingham, or from, we have the Whammy. So Montana, Wyoming, Idaho, and Alaska have no children's hospital.
So they're coming here.
They're coming here.
Okay.
Then we have people from the rest of the country that come here because we're so innovative. We have so many advances in medicine here. So those families come here.
Mm-hmm.
They don't have a home away from home to go to.
Sure.
So when dad brings the siblings to visit on the weekend or grandma comes in to visit, they stay at Ronald McDonald House,
mm-hmm.
which is lodging for the family while the child's in the hospital, or they stay in a motel or a hotel.
Okay.
But they don't all get that opportunity to just stay together.
Yeah.
They could at Ladybug House. Because remember, not everybody coming to Ladybug House is dying.
Sure.
They may still be in active treatment and just are coming in for respite support.
Mm-hmm. So having access to the hospital means they could go for the care mm-hmm. that they need there
mm-hmm.
and then come back to Ladybug House as
needed. Or if they're just parents were worried, like, what happens if something happens to my child? Mm-hmm. And it's not a do not resuscitate, you know? And they need to have care. They just need to know something's close by.
Sure.
So as long as we have a hospital or a place we could transport them to. So that gives us a lot of opportunities. So if anybody out there has any knowledge of 3 to 5 acres of land with a great view or a school or a nursing home or something that could be refabricated into a
30
home.
Minutes from a hospital?
From any hospital. Okay. That would be fabulous.
Nice.
Yeah.
Nice. So you guys are in the market.
We're in the market. We are taking out offers. Yes.
All right. I like it. All right. So as far as end-of-life care for children goes, what would be the most important takeaway for someone to learn about that, for a listener to learn about end-of-life care for a child?
That it really isn't about dying, it's about the living.
Yeah.
You know, it's about creating those moments. You don't really have hospice care for children.
Yeah.
You have life care.
Yeah.
You know, you're throwing proms, you're trying to make memories. Every parent who has a child, from the time they know that they're pregnant, has dreams and visions and images of what that life is going to be like.
Sure.
They have dreams that that's their legacy, mm-hmm. that somebody will be behind to tell their stories, you know, of who they were as a person.
Yeah.
And when a child's life is cut short, whether it's from cancer or any other disease, because Ladybug House will treat all illnesses, mm-hmm. you know, or support all families, those families so often, they're afraid that their child won't be remembered.
Yeah.
Or they won't have a legacy place. So you're not giving up hope, and you're really trying to find a way to celebrate every single day, to make every day matter, every moment matter.
Yeah.
And so I think what happens in the adult hospice world is we accept the 6 months.
Sure.
We're going into hospice care. Mm-hmm. Hospice care says we are accepting that we have 6 months or less to live. We're not doing any further curative measures. Mm-hmm. Parents don't do that.
They want to fight.
Fight, have hope, dream. Mm-hmm. And so we want to be that gentle support that's there to say, whatever you're choosing to do, if you're tired, we're here to help you.
Yeah. Nice.
These are kids, though. These are children. These are the kids, and they want to be kids. Mm-hmm. Even though they have cancer, even though they have terminal disease, they still want to be a kid. Mm-hmm. And in a hospital, you don't really have many opportunities to
just be a kid.
Yeah.
And so Ladybug House will be a place where there's activities, where there's memory makers, along with giving the break to the parents. They're enlightening every day. Maybe even there's a therapy pool, mm-hmm. Animals, arts, crafts for the siblings, you know, mm-hmm. to come in to be with their brother or sister, or possibly they're celebrating a birthday, a place to have a birthday party, a
watch
barbecue,
watch
a movie,
to try to be normal.
Try to be a normal family.
And just
function as a family. It's really difficult in the hospital scenario, to have that personal the chance to just enjoy and smile. You know, I see just a lot of smiles. I see a lot of happiness in such a tragic time. You have to get through every day and get the most out of every day, and it's just going to be something that people will cherish for their lifetime. It's just really important to support these families. They need it. And it's the least we can do for these kids and their families.
Yeah, and having only two organizations, two places where kids can go with their families, like Ladybug House right now in the country, that's mm-hmm. insane.
And the families that have gone to these places, they go back. Because this was a place of good memories. They want to support the other families because they know how important it was to them. Mm-hmm. We have our Ladybug Love program,
uh-huh.
where we go out and support families in need going through. Give some examples there.
treatment for one. We have a family who was originally from Tri-Cities.
Uh-huh.
They have four children, and their six-year-old is not only nonverbal autistic with autism, he had leukemia.
Oh, wow.
That treatment is 3.5 years long.
Wow.
So his initial part of the treatment, he was in the hospital for 9 months.
Yeah.
So dad stayed in one room with two beds at Ronald McDonald House with the other three kids. Their oldest daughter is also a type 1 diabetic.
Okay.
So dad had to leave his job to take care of the kids. So they were living at Ronald McDonald House. When their son got out of the hospital, they moved to Olympia here.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Because it was cheaper than living in Seattle.
Sure.
But now they have to commute every time he's sick to Seattle because he still has treatment every week.
Yeah.
You know, and whatnot. It's 3.5 years.
Yeah.
So therefore, so when we met them, they were really struggling. So mom and dad were sleeping on a twin mattress on the floor.
Yeah.
The teenagers, their time is spent traveling back and forth, sitting in a car or a hospital waiting room. So
uh-huh.
One loved to read. So we got donations from bookstores and Kindles and everything
yeah.
for her. The boy loved Michael Jordan. So we were able to get jerseys and shoes and stuff
nice.
For him. The youngest one, her birthday was coming up, and she loved Moana, so Argosy Cruises, we
yeah.
had a connection there, and they let the whole family go on for the day, and she was captain, and, you know,
oh,
got
nice.
To steer the boat, and, you know, so those were things that we were able to do. So we look also for communities to bring their businesses and whatnot to partner with
sure,
us, to
yeah.
adopt a family and help us do that.
Absolutely.
And then we found out, I put a question out there last November asking if any family had missed a meal or were hungry in the hospital while caring for their child. We had 164 responses
yeah.
of families. We also had three families that were homeless sleeping in their cars
oh, wow.
while their children. So now what we're trying to do is get donations to buy gift cards to the cafeteria
uh-huh.
and Starbucks cards
okay.
for families to help supplement those families that are in the hospital
sure.
for so long. Because if you're in the hospital, these kids aren't just in for weeks or days.
Yeah.
They're in there for months and sometimes years.
Yeah.
Hannah was 12. She was from Portland when she died.
Uh-huh.
And she had only been out of the hospital 72 days the last 2 years of her life.
Wow.
So those families lived in the hospital room.
Yeah.
So now you average a meal is, what, $10 a meal?
Mm-hmm.
By...
Yeah, and if you have a number of people in your family,
right. and you have
three meals
them,
a day, yeah, that's
so you
expensive.
Go broke. People are losing their livelihood, their houses. And remember, with children, as adults, in most cases, adults are more established.
Mm-hmm.
They may have a home. They may have a second income from a spouse or whatnot. If you're a young family and your child is diagnosed,
you still have to have a job to get
by. You still have to have a job.
Yeah.
You have other responsibilities. You're probably not on the high pay scale.
Yeah.
You probably may have just bought a home.
Uh-huh.
You may have just found out you're pregnant with your other a second child.
Uh-huh.
Or you may have found out that the second child is one with cancer.
Yeah.
So it's a lot of different scenarios.
Yeah. Cost prohibitive for sure.
Mm-hmm.
This is definitely something that is necessary, but
mm-hmm.
like
Absolutely.
I think you had mentioned earlier, not a lot of people think this mm-hmm. is part of planning for a child's life.
Mm-hmm.
People don't, they're not comfortable talking about children dying.
Yeah.
It's not a fun mm-hmm. subject, but
yeah.
it's a reality.
It is.
And it needs to be talked about.
Yeah.
I know somehow we've put life and death onto two different spectrums, you know,
yeah.
even as adults, we're a death phobic society,
mm-hmm.
you know, and so you have, and instead of saying that it's this lifeline, and for some of us, the line is shorter, you know,
mm-hmm.
but, you know, the turn of the century, we've changed so much. I was saying, like, when did non-responding become an acceptable response? You know, we send someone an email or a text message
yeah.
or whatever. And it's like, it's almost like that this is what we do in society. We don't respond, you know.
And you're
like,
supposed to glean something
yeah,
from the non-response.
I know. And then, you know, turn of the century, people would be, you know, if your neighbor was sick,
mm-hmm.
you know, people were bringing food to your door. They were plowing your field or thatching your roof. Or if you had somebody pass away, you know, they were helping to build the coffin or dig the grave and carry it out. We publicly mourned. We had rituals.
Yeah.
We wore black, we put, you know, wreaths on our door, or we drew our curtains, or
mm-hmm.
we sat Shiva. You know, we had rituals.
Mm-hmm.
Now we have 72 hours. You know, your parent died.
Yeah.
You have 3 days bereavement. Oh, it's 1,000 miles away. Oh, you might have 5 days.
I see
you know?
What you're saying. That's true.
You don't come
yeah.
to work and really talk about
yeah.
what your loss was.
Mm-hmm.
Not because it makes you uncomfortable, but because it makes
everyone else uncomfortable. Yeah. Yeah.
So imagine taking that to a child.
Yeah.
Sally, how's your baby? She died.
Yeah. And nobody wants to talk about that.
Yeah, it's like, oh, I'm sorry. Instead of, it needs to be turned around more. How can I help?
Yes.
But because of the discomfort that it causes to other people, these families, so there's a group, so when people are really sick, they have different groups, whether it's mitochondrial mm-hmm. disease, a spinal muscular atrophy, or a cancer, mm-hmm. they have their communities. But when those children actually die,
do they have a community after?
Because they're so isolated, because those people fighting, you mm-hmm. know, in there, they don't, that's the unimaginable, right?
Yeah.
The outcome. So you really don't want, it's kind of like, think about it, I mean, this day and age, you know, people are married, they're mm-hmm. couples, you're together, you have your couple friends, but when that one couple friend gets divorced,
yeah,
what happens to the relationships with those two people? Most often, some people might have individual relationships, but they're not part of the couple group yeah. anymore, right? Because they don't really fit in there. Mm-hmm. And, oh, for around them, well, who do we invite? How do we do this? Because yeah. it makes them uncomfortable.
Sure.
Well, these parents are the same way. So bereaved parents are a whole other category because it is really hard to find support for them. So Ladybug House will be a place for survivorship support, because that's hard too.
Yeah.
When you have a child, you know, as an adult, I'm a pediatric. I still work at Swedish Cancer Clinic okay. on top of this. So I work with adults now. And, you know, you have the whole survivorship. So even though you're done with treatment, mm-hmm. there's still the chances that it will always come back. You're yeah. getting scans. With kids, those chances are huge. Because if you have cancer when you're two,
yeah.
the chances that, you know, they say 5 to 10 years, usually there's a secondary recurrence.
Okay.
You're still a child then. Plus the fact that we've only had 2 new drugs developed for children in the oncology world in the last 30 years.
Wow.
So treatments are usually modified adult protocols. So if you're getting radiation to your head when you're 2 years old,
yeah.
or you've had an amputation, or they've resected your heart or your liver or your kidneys,
mm-hmm.
the chances are that you have comorbidities or you have secondary diseases
okay.
that you have to treat. So you may cure the original disease.
But you've caused another.
Ongoing treatments.
Okay.
You know,
Ladybug House is gigantic. It's just, I really look forward to having the ability to give to these families and to make smiles and to make moments, take away some of the stress, some of the pressures. That's a good word. Take away some of the pressures from these families so that they can just sit and enjoy their child
yeah.
instead of having
to be the caregiver.
The caregiver. Mm-hmm.
So let's say someone listens to the podcast and they decide they want to start giving to Ladybug House. Can you talk about what donations do for your organization, even without having the house itself, right. but like as you guys are in the office space,
mm-hmm.
like what do donations do for you?
Well, it's important for everyone to know that this is 100% volunteer operation.
Yeah.
Money's given, because you hear about so many nonprofits, a lot of the money goes to people.
Sure.
Or 100% of the donations go towards Ladybug House and our efforts.
Mm-hmm. And so the thing is that right now, like Colleen mentioned, we mm-hmm. have 2 programs. Our outreach program called Ladybug Love
yeah.
is where we pick a family a month and we are, you know, we reach out to them and we try to support them. So we've paid rent, you know, for the month. We're able with that family to help get them a bed and get
yeah.
them things for their kids. That
yeah.
And then our feeding program, reaching out to the community, you know, and being able to buy the gift cards. We do things like we'll have people, you know, we're able to send people to baseball games, you know, just
okay.
we've had, you know, organizations donate tickets to us, and being able to just send a family to it, like a family of 8
yeah.
to a baseball game, who no way could they afford
absolutely,
that on
yeah.
their own.
Colleen?
Yes.
Suzanne, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast today.
Mm-hmm. Oh, you're welcome.
All right, so that was your 2 interviews
hey.
with Nick of Time Foundation and Ladybug House. It was those were very neat interviews.
You're welcome to come back next time.
I think I might try and actually join you.
Okay.
So Try to make that a regular thing.
Oh, okay. Yeah. I like it.
But I saw you putting out all of these lovely papers and graphs. Yeah. So why don't you walk me through facts, statistics about this particular issue?
So I didn't find, like Suzanne had said in the interview, there's not a lot out there about end-of-life care for children.
Okay.
So I did find a little bit more when it comes to just general mortality within children. So there is, first of all, child chronic illnesses. There are about 31% of children, according to a 1988
holy cow. Is National that the Health latest study they have?
Survey. It's the latest one I found. And I was like, huh.
Yeah, wow, this was 1988.
Yeah, and the paper that it was in was published in 1992. So,
oh, man. Yeah, it's, man, it's this is like the Berlin Wall was still up by that point.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, so at this time, it turns out that there are high respiratory conditions, repeated ear infections and asthma that are chronic within children. Mm-hmm. And 67% of these children have mild conditions that result in little or don't bother them too much.
Okay.
Little activity or don't bother them too much. But then I was looking at sudden cardiac arrest, and did you know? Yeah. There's an RCW about that.
What?
I know. Right?
Wow. Okay. So, okay.
You know, along with like passing budgets.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And things, they also do this.
They also do this.
Okay.
So RCW 28A.600.195, sudden cardiac arrest in youth athletes. There's an online pamphlet about it, and prevention for coaches.
Okay.
So something that Darla had talked about was that they try to get into schools and get organizations to have this information because they are required by law to have it now.
Wow. I had seen way back in the day when I was in high school, I had seen when news was, you know,
the news
good at it.
Let's check those facts.
Yeah. There was a 2020 that talked about a rash of kids who were playing baseball and had gotten hit in the chest.
Okay.
And then had a heart attack as a result. So there were these rules and laws being passed where kids playing high school baseball had to wear vests. Never made it to our school.
Sure.
But I could see where, like, that sort of thing ends up like sort of like melding into the law.
Yeah.
So there must have been an incident of some kind that kind of spurred that sort of law. That's interesting.
Yeah, because that's one thing that Darla talked about as well, is that it doesn't have to be just like a hereditary thing. Like, you can have some kind of impact to your chest.
Right. Right. Well, yeah, and you know, they're not as fully developed.
Yeah, exactly.
And all that sort of
stuff.
They're
still going through changes.
You hear that all the time about the football thing, like kids who play football with their heads, you know, they end up having CTE far, you know, it's far more likely that they'll have severe CTE earlier than some of these other ball players.
It's pretty crazy.
Yeah, yeah, I don't know why we subject them to that. That's stupid. Anyway, continue.
You gonna change some laws for us?
No, I will not be changing any laws.
I'm just gonna wrap everybody in bubble wrap and helmets.
No. I think my kids will play flag football for as long as I can get them to play flag football. Yeah.
If they care about it at all.
Yeah, if they care about it at all, I don't know if they will. But if they want to play football, it won't be tackle.
Your daughter would be a fiend out there. She'd be like defense.
She'd be vicious. Mm-hmm. She'd be vicious. Yeah, she'd be biting people.
I love it.
Anyway,
so
sorry.
The last statistic I have is from the World Health Organization.
Yeah.
So it's a graph that compares 1990 to 2016.
Okay.
And it's about under 5 mortality declining in all WHO regions.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. So
all of them.
All of them.
That's excellent.
Yeah. So that's great news.
Yeah.
And like in 1990, the under 5 mortality, it was per 1,000 live births.
Mm-hmm.
They had this level of 177 out of 1,000 live births in Africa, children who were dying under 5.
Wow.
But now it's down to 81.3.
Wow, that's awesome.
So it's a great decline. So
that's
each
amazing.
Region, Africa, America, Southeast Asia, Europe, Eastern Mediterranean, Western Pacific, has declined. So globally, it's declined from 90.6 to 42.5. So it's great.
Yeah.
But, you know, I mean, that is still 42.5 out of 1,000 deaths.
So I wonder then where the talking point of America has this horrible mortality rate comes from, like in terms of the developed world. Everyone always says that we're like, you know, 30th or whatever in like developed world.
I have no idea. Maybe the WHO was like, whatever, facts.
Maybe they have facts.
I don't know.
I don't know.
Anyway, put this graph up so people can check it out.
That's very cool. Yeah. That's a very cool graph. It's also a little bit hopeful. That's kind of nice.
What color is it?
It's blue and red, or sort of a burnt orange, if you will. Hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Why? What color? What's this? What do you say?
Bears.
Oh, my gosh.
I know. Isn't that gross?
This is ridiculous.
Mm-hmm. Also, I loved that you didn't have to be here to mention Michael Jordan. Suzanne.
I know.
Brought up Michael Jordan.
Unbelievable.
And it also made me, like, my heart soared a little to know there are children out there, who care about Michael Jordan.
I know. His legacy lives on forever, especially since the guy who's supposed to match up with him just keeps signing mercenary contracts here and everywhere.
Contract.
So that was pretty cool.
Yeah,
we kept our legacy going without me even having to be here.
I love it.
So we don't have much in the way of upcoming events right now. We are actually in the planning stages for our campaign leaders. We just had campaign leader training about a month ago, and gave them some tips and tricks on how to basically operate their next phase, which is recruiting local coordinators, the volunteers in local offices around the state. Folks will be able to order this year's marketing supplies and last year's marketing supplies in a couple weeks. So look out for that. And then also big thing is local coordinator trainings begin in very early August. They'll bleed into September this year. But we'll also have some events and promotions coming up doing that. And the other thing I want to say is we will, for those who actually do listen to the show, we will have a show that goes off every single day during the campaign called The Daily Drip. And it's a simple show. It's not what these are, where we have intricate and deeper conversations. Mm-hmm. These are 10 minutes. We talk about a single charity. We talk about that issue sort of super fast. And then we actually hit on some different donation impacts. $5 does this, $10 does this, $20 does this. And that all comes from the charities. We've been collecting information over the last couple months.
Yeah, more proof that if you feel like you're not giving enough, it doesn't matter. You're doing good enough.
Yeah. You're doing good enough. Trust me. Yeah, it's really cool. So watch for that. It will accompany these episodes, these bigger episodes with where we have deeper conversations with charities. Those will just be quick ones, that we go through during the campaign.
Yeah.
So that's basically it for this week's podcast. Thank you very much for listening, and we hope you have a good week.
Bye.